Open the door to huge savings now at Menards. Enhance the appearance of your home with a new stylish garage door. Choose from our large in-stock selection of ideal garage doors or design your own using our free garage door designer in-store or on Menards.com. Save big and ideal garage doors. And don't forget to check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for all the great deals happening now. Save big money
at Menards. Hi, I'm Richard Karn, and you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free pocket pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. W-A-T-E-R to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hose. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethose.com/terms.
Looking for the perfect slice? Milano's Pizza has been a local favorite since 1970, serving up delicious homemade pizzas alongside a menu filled with mouth-watering sandwiches, fresh salads, hearty pasta dishes, and irresistible desserts. Conveniently located at 215 North 17th Street in Niles, Michigan, Milano's is open Monday through Thursday from 4 to 8 p.m., Friday and Saturday from 4 to 9 p.m., and also offers a special lunch service from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m., Tuesday through Friday. Whether you're grabbing a quick bite or feeding the whole family, Milano's offers both pickup and delivery to make enjoying their food even easier. Support a beloved local business and taste the tradition. Stop by or place your order today. They think we're lazy.
They think we're weak-willed.
They think we're entitled.
They think we're selfish.
They think we don't care about anybody but ourselves.
We are compassionate.
We are resourceful.
We are capable.
We want to make a difference in the world.
We are underestimated.
In our last episode, we uncovered some of the unsettling details surrounding Janice Sanders and the mysterious events leading up to her disappearance. We also introduced a shadowy figure, one who had been reported as stalking Janice in the days before she vanished. In this episode, we will pull back the curtain on the man's true involvement in her case. His name is Gerald Libertowski, but to those closest to him, he was simply known as Jerry. He is the main suspect in the case and is the alleged killer. Dan told us a little bit about Jerry's line of work. In later years, he worked in the construction business. When Jerry was younger, he worked under the company A&B Builders. A&B Builders was a construction company. It was under this company that Jerry met Myron Hunsberger. Later in time, Jerry left the company to go into a construction business with his father, Casimir.
Dan told us that as a father, Jerry was a good guy. He taught morals like treating others how you wanted to be treated, respecting everyone, and also farming skills. Although Dan didn't live with his dad at the time, we still got valuable information about who Jerry was as a person. Dan told us that he would never imagine his dad to commit a crime like this, as he respected everyone.
I mean, the way I was raised and brought up, we did he was very close with family. We did family meals every Sunday. The way my dad showed respect to people, I never...
He just didn't seem like that type of...
Never.
Jerry Labertowski had a reputation as a hard-working man in the construction business. Little did anyone know, his line of work would leave an even darker legacy. It was a career that his son, Dan, eventually followed. But Dan's memories of his father are far more complex than a simple work ethic. In our conversation with him, Dan revealed that Jerry wasn't just a tough, determined man. He was someone who, in his later years, seemed to grow more and more consumed by a set of values that were questionable, to say the least. So, what exactly did Jerry instill in his son? And how does his past tie into Janice's disappearance? In this episode, we dive deeper into Jerry Labertowski's life, unraveling a story that may make you question everything you thought you knew about him, and the role he may have played in a mystery that remains unsolved.
After our interview with Dan, we discovered that Jerry had a daughter, Cheryl Labertowski. Cheryl was also alive during the time that the case occurred, and she was able to give us firsthand information based on exactly what she witnessed.
You know, everybody knew about it. Everybody was pointing fingers at me. Oh, that's his kid. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So it was really just, it was a lot of trauma. I mean, I understand that those, her kids went through a lot of trauma too. And I worried about her kids on a regular basis because they ended up having to go live with their dad. And that's a whole nother topic. But yeah, I mean, it just, it, that, if I had to sum it all up, I would just say trauma.
Both children had said very similar things about their dad. I'd say that Jerry was a good father, but the debate about him being a good person yet to be determined.
Earlier in this episode, we briefly mentioned a man named Myron. His full name was Myron Hunsberger. Remember this name, as we'll go more into detail about him later. Jerry had met Myron under the company A&B Builders. It was under this company that they had formed a good friendship. Myron and Jerry would go on to be almost best of friends. They would spend time together outside of work doing different things.
So let's get into how Gerald Labertowski is involved with the Janice Sanders case. Gerald, Jerry as many people called him, was Janice Sanders' ex-boyfriend. And he was the male that was reported to be last seen with Janice. In the case file, we have a report from Randy Riley, who was a co-worker of Janice Sanders, who worked in the kitchen. He was working the Sunday that Janice went missing. He said that Janice left around 12 o'clock a.m. He followed her out to ask if she had clocked out, and she responded with a yes, that she did in fact clock out. While he was asking her if she had punched out, he noticed a male was walking towards Janice. After going back inside to finish up working, he said he didn't see either subject again that night. This same male had been sitting in the bar and seemed intoxicated. Riley stated one time that the male's eyes rolled back into his head. When talking to officers, Riley also said that this male had no cuts, scars, or bruises on him. When describing the male, Riley said that the man was around 35 to 40 years old, blonde hair and about 6 foot and 180 pounds. When Randy went to leave around 12:30 a.m., he said that Sanders' car was gone. Now let's go back to episode one. As you guys learned, her boyfriend at the time said that her car was still there at her work around 1 a.m. But as we just learned, Randy says that her car was gone around 12:30 a.m. when she left work. You guys also learned that Brenda McMillan had also seen a suspicious male at Janice's work on July 20th. Brenda stated that that male was Mr. Gerald Labertowski. Next, let's talk about the evidence that was found. In an interview with Kathy Haley, she told detectives that she saw Janice Sanders on July 19th while they were apartment shopping. Detectives then asked Haley if she would be able to describe the type of purse Janice had. Haley said that yes, Janice had a red clutch which was being carried in a large white shoulder bag. Haley then further explained that she saw the red clutch several times on July 19th, when Janice had opened the clutch to show pictures of her children to Haley. Then she saw it again when Janice had pulled out a pen to write down apartment information. Haley said that there was a plastic card slash picture holder which had a lucky dime. On April 13th, 1976, police recovered a purse from Jerry's house. Detectives showed photographs of the purse they found to Haley, and Haley said that was possibly the purse she had described as belonging to Janice Sanders. So then we are left wondering why and how Jerry had Janice's purse.
With Simone, I began digging deeper into case files, and I saw an interview between Detective Long and Janice's adoptive mom, Joanna McCauley. During this interview, she had mentioned that a compact and a hairpin case that Janice used and would definitely have her fingerprints on was found in Jerry's house. This interview was conducted on July 31st, 1975.
Another big thing that is important to note is that Gerald had a cut on his face on July 21st. That cut had not been there on July 20th, 1975. We have a picture of that cut. Another thing to note is that in the case files that we were able to obtain, I found a statement from Carolyn Judd, one of Gerald's acquaintances. In this statement, Carolyn had said that Gerald had come to her apartment around 9:30 p.m. on July 21st. When he got to her place, she noticed he had a bump on the right side of his head above his eye. While Gerald was in her apartment, he said that she, Janice, was gone. Carolyn then asked what he meant, and he said in response to that, "I guess I'm going to be in trouble over this." After that, Carolyn told Gerald not to tell her anymore and that she didn't want to be involved, and then he left her apartment. He didn't stay long, maybe around 10 minutes or so, because he said the cops were after him. Also, in an interview with Randy Riley again, he told detectives that he saw Gerald on July 20th and that Gerald had no cuts or bruises or bumps on his face.
So, Jerry was known to be a bit of a violent person, especially when he was drunk. In one instance, he saw Joseph Pasker with his girlfriend and thought they were on a date. Because of this, he, quote, slashed Joseph's Corvette top, broke the windshield, damaged the left front door, and made a hole in the rear of his car. Janice never explicitly said that Jerry beat her and her kids, but she did imply this on several occasions and to several people. Janice's mother even said that she saw red marks on Janice's son, James, who was only 2 years old at the time. This is why it is puzzling to me as to why Janice never left. When she finally did leave and she was apartment shopping with Kathy Haley, she said to her how she was scared of Jerry and definitely did not want an apartment in South Bend.
Drivers who switch and save with Progressive could save hundreds. With that kind of money, you could go big time on a fancy water bottle with ultra-titanium alloy metal. You're not sure why you need all that. I mean, it just holds water. But you're getting it anyway. Because if you're hiking near an active volcano and you accidentally drop the bottle into molten lava, your water will still be icy cold. Switch to Progressive and you could save big time for water bottles. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and affiliates. Not available in all states. Potential savings will vary.
Hey, are you looking for a true crime podcast to binge?
Check out True Crime Obsessed, where we recap the true crime documentaries everyone's talking about.
We've been one of the top true crime podcasts for almost 9 years.
And we have over 400 episodes for you to check out right now.
We cover the cases everyone is talking about, and we also highlight the cases that have been underreported, overlooked, or forgotten.
With over 30,000 five-star reviews on Apple Podcasts, if you've never checked out True Crime Obsessed, now's the time to give us a try.
Find True Crime Obsessed wherever you get your podcasts.
Now, I would like to talk a little bit about the partners of Jerry. Just a forewarning, Jerry was not always faithful to the women he dated, so a lot of the women and when they dated Jerry will be overlapping. There are 9 women I will be discussing, but there could be more. These are just the women that I have read about in the case file, like those that were interviewed and gave statements and things like that. In 1962, he was married to Doris Jo Starr, now Doris Jo Tucker, and they had a daughter, Cheryl. During the marriage, Jerry would be open about other girlfriends, and sometimes they would even come over to the house looking for him. In 1967, the case Libertowski versus Hojera took place. This was a legal battle over child support and childbirth bills for Jerry and Janice Hojera's daughter, Teresa. Jerry ended up having to pay $10 a month for child support. Just to be clear, this was in 1967, right in the middle of Jerry and Doris's marriage. Also, while they were married, Jerry dated Marcia Sue Raver, or Shriver. From January to May 1970, he had convinced her to move out of his parents' house and into an apartment. As I was reading this, I thought, why wouldn't Jerry ask her to move into his apartment or his house? Because that's what he did with his other girlfriends. But that was before I realized that he was actually still married at the time. He offered to pay her bills, but she said she wasn't that kind of girl. Marcia actually said in an interview that Jerry drank more than usual, he was a convincing liar, and he was very jealous and possessive of her. But she never saw him completely lose his temper, and he never physically harmed her. Jerry and Doris separated in 1971 and were divorced in 1972. Doris had custody of Cheryl. Now, sometime during all of this, Carol and Jed had gone out with Jerry. Not real seriously, though. According to Carolyn, they met in 69, and in her words, she dated him rarely every 6 months or so. His next girlfriend was Janice Langs, whom he dated for about a year and a half, and they were even engaged to be married, but the engagement was broken off in 1973. Right around the time Janice and Jerry's relationship ended, Beth Ann Donovan started to date Jerry, but only for a few months, and then they started dating again in July of 1975. Between the times Jerry and Beth Ann dated was when Jerry and Janice dated and were living together. Jerry and Beth Ann only dated for a few months in 75, and by the time their relationship ended, he had started dating Janine Hughes. After he dated Janine, he dated Winnie Wrightley, whom he was married to for the rest of his life. They were actually engaged in 1976 while the trial for the Janice Sanders case was going on. So I think Jerry must have had a lot of charm because he was pretty popular among the ladies. And while he was known to be violent when he was drunk, the women that were interviewed didn't seem to be afraid of him. He only seemed to be physically violent with Janice and her kids and Janice Langs. Maybe it's just a coincidence, but none of the other women he dated turned up missing.
Jerry had relationships with many women, one of whom was Beth Ann Donovan, as Miriam had previously mentioned. During the time period of this case, Jerry and Beth's relationship was short-lived. However, there was an interview that was conducted between Beth and Detective Miller. This interview leaves me a little uneasy because her answers were very unsure. Now, you will hear Monse and Miriam quote the transcript directly pulled from the interview.
Was it summertime or wintertime?
It was in the winter. It was around January.
Okay, it could have been January 74 or January 75 then.
I think it was...
Does this help that it was in November of 73 that another woman went missing? Would it have been January of 74 or January 75?
Oh boy.
That is when you first met him.
Yeah, I think it was 74.
So it would have been just shortly after she turned up missing?
Yeah.
At a point when Myron, Jerry's friend, had told Beth that she didn't have to be scared of Jerry, she had said she wasn't because of what we already know about Jerry. And I think that Beth was actually scared of Jerry, but she would present herself as fierce and brave and that she was not concerned about what Jerry was up to, but in reality, when she was away from Jerry, she was actually nervous. Myron then asked her if she was scared of Jerry, and her response was if she were afraid of Jerry, then she wouldn't be here with him. Myron had asked this question because there was another girl that disappeared 2 years before Janice.
I left you off with dropping the bomb on you that the suspicious man in the bar was actually Janice's ex-boyfriend. And now we all know all about him, Jerry Libertowski. I wanted a deep dive into the days leading into Janice's disappearance. I will be talking mostly about the 2 days prior to the disappearance of Janice. I also wanted to put out here that all my information I will be stating is strictly from the case file, most specifically Janice's adoptive mother, Joanna's interview, between Edward Chaplew and Janice Sanders' mother. Throughout the year and a half Janice and Jerry were dating, She was living with him, but things started getting rocky. And that's when Janice decided to move out of Jerry's house and into her mother's house. Just so you can get a picture of the next events that are happening, Janice officially moved into her mother's house Friday, July 18th. She went missing on the 20th. Friday. Jerry helped Janice move out the last 2 days, and Joanna states that she's never seen a man cry so much. Joanna sees that Janice isn't bothered, and she's confused as to why. It's later that night that Janice tells her the reason she was so unbothered by Jerry's presence. It was because earlier that day, Jerry had taken her car, drove it to Shula's, which for those of you living in Niles is the bowling alley in front of Campbell Ford. He got a gun and threatened to shoot himself. And then Janice tells Jerry,
"Why should you shoot yourself? You should kill me instead."
And that's when Janice quotes that she thought that if he was going to kill her, that's what she was looking for. Saturday. Janice went on a date with Kenneth, and later that night, Jerry stopped by the house to see where Janice was. But Joanna told him that Janice was out, but she didn't mention that Janice was with Kenneth, which I found a bit odd. Sunday morning. Jerry calls Joanna, asks her if Janice can help him with the washing machine. This is where Janice tells her mother that Jerry knows exactly how to use the washing machine, and it was there before she even moved in. Later that day, Janice tells her mother that she's going to see Kenneth after work. And this was the last time Janice's mother would see her. Now, this is kind of where episode 1 takes place, with Janice going to work and Kenneth not following after her. But while I was reading all these case files, it astonishes me that although Kenneth knew about Janice and Jerry, he didn't even try to chase after her. He could have potentially seen something or saved her. As I stated, we are now following up with episode 1, and this is picking up that next morning. This is when Joanna realizes that Janice didn't come home, so she just assumed Janice went to spend the night with Kenneth. But Kenneth didn't have a phone, so she couldn't call him. Jerry ends up calling Joanna that morning to ask Janice if he could have the sewing machine cabinet that he bought her for Christmas back. But obviously she wasn't home. And all Joanna said was that she talked to Janice. Later that day, around 2:30, Joanna starts to panic about Janice and calls her brother at the tavern because she knows Kenneth and his work buddies all go there, and he assures her that Kenneth is in fact there, but Janice is not. This is where Janice's mother learns that Janice left work with Jerry the night before. So right now she's on the phone with Kenneth. And Joanna asks Kenneth,
"Well, why didn't you go after them?"
"I just thought Janice wanted to get back with him."
As Joanna's on the phone speaking to Kenneth, he tells her that he parked outside of their house the night before to see if Janice would come home, but she didn't, so he ended up leaving. Joanna was furious at this point, and she gets back on the phone to call Jerry and ask him why he didn't tell her that he was with Janice that night. He responds with,
"I can't talk right now. I'll call you back later."
And he hangs up the phone. This is like the cherry on top for Joanna because no one can tell her where her daughter is. So she ends up calling the police, and when they arrived, the first suspect she told them was Jerry Libertowski. The cops talked to Joanna about another missing person connected to Jerry, and she mentioned something Janice had said.
"Some men have troubles with ex-wives, some with girlfriends. My competition is a ghost."
Janice's mother asks who she's talking about, but Janice doesn't tell her. She told her that she was asking Jerry about Janice's disappearance, and Joanna asks, "Well, what does Jerry have to do with this case?" Janice tried to ignore the question, but finally she said,
"He knows where she's at. He knows what happened to her."
The ghost Janice is referring to is Janice Langs, a previous girlfriend of Jerry who went missing and she's never been found. She was gone for 20 months and then out of nowhere, Janice goes missing. Suspicious, isn't it? Hopping back onto the conversation between the cops and Joanna, she's telling them a story about how at the end of 74, Janice called her and asked if she'd seen the article about the missing girl, Janice. She told her that she was asking Jerry about Janice's disappearance, and Joanna asked, well, what does Jerry have to do with this case? Janice tried to ignore the question, but she finally said,
he knows where she's at. He knows what happened to her.
And I said, well, how do you know he knows? And that's when Janice tells me, and I said, well, how come he doesn't tell the police where she's at? And she said, Mom. That was the end of the second side of tape. In the next tape, Joanna tells us that Janice didn't want to say anything because she didn't want to get Jerry in trouble. Applause to Janice because she could have solved this poor missing girl's case, but chose not to because she loved a man. That basically sums up what I know. I think it's time for us to debrief about this. For me, I'm just in shock the whole time I was reading this case file. Okay, so now we know that Janice knew about Janice's disappearance and where she was. What do you guys think?
I just feel it's like we didn't think to just tell. I feel like she should have.
I think she should have told, but she was probably scared because what if he actually would have killed her next?
Yeah. So why do we think Jerry killed Janice?
I think there's a bit of a pattern going on with women in Jerry's life where they like to protect him because we learned that Carolyn Jed also knew that Jerry had cuts and, like, you know, he was suspected of being involved in this, and she didn't say anything and didn't want him saying anything to her about it because she didn't want to be involved, which right, is the same as Janice.
Maybe she was scared that, like, she knew what happened to the girl. She's like, oh my God, what if I'm next? So I don't want to know anything, because then if word gets out, like, he might kill
her. I think later in the file, she had told cops that she didn't say anything and didn't want to be involved because of her job as a teacher. But at the same time, your job shouldn't take precedent over a woman's life and her livelihood.
But also, what would you do in that predicament? Like, literally anything could happen.
Well, he left. He was only there for like 10 minutes, so.
Miriam. I don't remember if it was Miriam or Simone. Oh, the cuts on his face. So we know that the night at the bar, he didn't have anything on his face. He was clean. And then the next day when people see him, we have a picture of it. He has bruises on his face. He has scratches. Like, he said that he fell. Isn't that what?
Yeah, there's a couple different things. And then I know, like, in the photo, isn't, like, one eye, like, significantly, like, puffed up?
Yes.
Than the other?
It's like a monster. So he says that he fell.
Himself on a beam in the garage. He said he fell
off a ladder or something. Like, there's, like, several different things that he said that happened.
There could be another side of the story, but everything is just adding up to where it's just... And again, how I told you guys, do you guys remember how I said that Jerry got a gun?
Mm-hmm.
And he, like, went... Basically, Janice was scared that he was going to kill himself. So, what if the reason he was going to kill himself is because he knew Janice was going to say something? So then he wanted to scare Janice and be like, oh, I'm going to kill myself. But then...
So then she didn't.
He had drinks. I don't know if I said that, but he had drinks that night at the bar.
Oh, yeah.
So what if he was just intoxicated and he got mad at Janice and then followed her out to the car and then said if they could talk? We don't know what happened because they don't have anything. So my theory is he might have hit her or something. She went unconscious. He took her into his car and drove off, trying to figure out what to do with her.
Well, my other thing, me and Miriam have both like been thinking about, like, have been talking about this back and forth, but we had found out that Janice had moved out. She started her new job at Peace Patio and she had told no one. But my thing was, like, why didn't she tell anyone?
Because she was probably scared.
Yeah. But then, did Liberty House just go there because he had known that she worked there? Or did he go there just because? That was my thought process.
Yeah, if, like, she didn't tell anyone, how would he know to go there?
Right, that's,
where she worked, unless...
Maybe, like, they're missing something in the case file. Maybe, like... Janice's mom told Jerry that she was at work.
that she worked at Pete's Patio. Like, we never know, like, what. But I just think it's, I don't know. There's a couple odd things that when you guys were reading it, I'm like, wow, that's.
Why did he call her mom the day after to ask if she's there when he knows she's not? Because
that was his alibi. Like, what if he's like, oh, I'm going to do this. So, like, they don't suspect it was me, you know?
Also, to see if her mom knows that she's missing.
We have so much more to unpack for you in the next episodes, but until then, goodbye. Underestimated, J&J was researched, written, and produced by Avery, Elena, Miriam, Simone, Monte, and Lexi. Intro music by Haley, all other music by Shane Yoder. Our show artwork was created by Chelsea, and our series artwork was created by Lexi. The Underestimated podcast is a production created in the Brandywine Community Schools Broadcasting CTE program. We want to thank you for listening, and a huge thank you to our community sponsors for supporting us and helping fund our work. Please make sure to leave us a review on your favorite podcast player, and we'll be back next week with another episode of Underestimated.
For a true crime podcast to binge?
Check out True Crime Obsessed, where we recap the true crime documentaries everyone's talking about.
We've been one of the top true crime podcasts for almost 9 years.
And we have over 400 episodes for you to check out right now.
We cover the cases everyone is talking about, and we also highlight the cases that have been underreported, overlooked, or forgotten.
With over 30,000 five-star reviews on Apple Podcasts, if you've never checked out True Crime Obsessed, now's the time to give us a try.
Find True Crime Obsessed wherever you get your podcasts.